This is the Empower Podcast, released September 11th, 2023. Episode 646, Fanboys.
Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Dave Jones from the EEV blog.
And I'm Chris Gamble of Contextual Electronics.
Should we change our intro? We've been doing this crap for like 13 years now.
Oh, I'm not too fussed.
No, not too fussed. Okay.
No. I could go first sometimes, but you push back on that.
Absolutely. No, age. Age comes first.
Age before
I'm
beauty.
Afraid.
Yeah.
Yep, that's it.
That's fine. Don't worry about it.
Okay, right.
I am older than I am when we started this, Dave.
Significantly, but so am I. It's gone up in a linear proportion.
Yeah, that's how it goes. Yeah.
Although it doesn't feel like that. It feels,
of course.
Logarithmic, but, you know.
Right.
Anyway. Yeah.
I am no longer a seller on Tindy.
Oh, I didn't know you were a seller on Tindy.
I know.
Selling what?
I was selling this like tiny little 555 soldering kit. It was basically just for DEF CON like four or five years ago. And then I got surprised. I had been giving these things away at conferences, you know, just like, I was like, oh, I'm not going to sell any more of these.
Right.
I got surprised the other day and someone's like, yeah, I'm going to buy one. I was like, oh my God, it's still listed.
It's still there. I have had that. Yep, I've had that. Where have I? I've sold something obscure in the past and it's still on my website and people send it, you know, and it was like a service that, like, I haven't thought, like, it was Clickbank. It was, I think it's...
Like a payment service or something?
It's like a payment service that was, you know, before credit cards, like online credit cards were like really, you know, a thing. You had to use these obscure services. What? Clickbank? You know, I get this notice from freaking, you know, like somebody's bought something that I had on the website from, like, God, nobody's bought that in 10 years. I didn't even know that was still a thing.
Yeah.
And So you just annoyingly, so you just went, holy crap.
I shipped the last two I had. You got a twofer.
Oh, so you did ship them. Okay.
Yeah, but now I'm officially no longer a seller. I keep thinking like, you know, it's not that hard to like, it seems like something that could be worth doing, but then I'm actually in awe of the people that are on like Tindy or equivalent that are just selling little things
for $5-$10 and stuff like that. I will refuse to sell anything on eBay if it's under like $50. It's just not worth my time.
Right.
Like,
exactly.
honestly, like
I get out the packing labels, right? It's just crazy.
I don't want to sound, you know, elitist or anything, but you know, like that's something I used to do, but now my time is just, you know, the older I get, speaking of age, right, the older I get, more valuable my time,
it's a more precious commodity,
is. Yeah, exactly. Back when I was 20, I was mailing out floppy disks, you know, in the mail, right, actual floppy ones, 5.5 inch, 5.25 inch,
That's great.
For $10 a pop or whatever it was.
Do you guys have media mail over there? Is that a thing? Like, could you do that on media mail?
Well, you can get I bought these cardboard mailers, and you could get 5.25 mailers, and the 3.5 inches were just fine in there too. So I use those for So you'd ship these hard cardboard.
It's a thing. It's a USPS thing. So the postal service here. It's like a lower rate if you're just like, if you want to like ship a book like super slow, but then I think like records and CDs as well.
Yes, right. Yeah, Amazon took advantage of that back in the old days, didn't they? Like when they were first starting, I think.
I don't remember. Amazon. My main experience with it was like buying and selling textbooks. Just for usage, not for like profit.
Yeah, yeah.
Definitely not for profit. But yeah, I noticed that they did have it for other things out there, and now I don't know who would ship.
We didn't have specific rules for that, except that it got the same rate as so it's based on size, thickness, and weight. So if it met that, then it could go via just a local stamp, you know.
Oh, like a letter, yeah.
Yeah, stamp, yeah. Yeah, so it only cost, you know, 30 cents back in the day or something to post it. Now stamps $1 or something, I think. I don't know.
Wow.
But yeah. So yeah, that was a thing. And yeah, I would ship by, you know, somebody sent me a money order, you know, so I had to go to the post office, line up at the post office to cash my $15 money order. Yeah. Please give me my $15 in cash, please. You know, and then there was a $2 processing fee or something, you know.
Sure. Yeah, the things in the inefficient younger days.
I was young and I was making money and it didn't, you know, it was fun and, you know, it's like, yeah. But no, it's not something that I would do these days. I wouldn't sell a $10 thing.
It did bring you to where you currently are, Dave, so you really can't get
that. Oh, yeah, no, totally, right? Yeah. But
the software maven that you are, you know, brought you here.
Yeah. But no, I'm not going to sell something for $20 on eBay. It's like I would rather have it for free. I'd rather, you know, just... wouldn't even bother with the shipping, right? I
have someone send you
shove it on Gumtree. Somebody turns up, picks it up.
Self-addressed stamped envelope.
Yeah, right.
Just do those line.
Yeah.
Classic.
Yeah. I used to buy things with stamps.
You'd buy them with stamps? Like
you would
prison?
Actually send stamps as payment. Colin Mitchell, Talking Electronics, who I've done a five-part interview series with.
Sure, he was in Melbourne.
And he would accept, like he sold kits, right? Sold, you know, hundreds of thousands of kits, and he would accept stamps as payment because he was like shipping stuff every day. So you didn't have to pay him. All you had to do was go to the post office and you'd send him like a whole bunch of stamps. And that was the payment for your item because it didn't matter
whether it was
cash or stamps.
It's
all
fungible, basically.
Yeah. It's all fungible. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So
That's interesting. Yeah.
It's great.
I mean, that is like literally like in like prison movies, you see people like,
right. Yeah. They have traded,
you know, interacting with stamps,
smokes,
stuff,
you know,
right?
They trading
well,
scenes,
stamps
you know?
Too, like books of stamps. Because you can get stamps.
Yeah.
That's and they have actual value like internally and externally.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. So, right. Yep. Yeah. So anyway, right. Yeah. So you're in the same thing. You wouldn't bother selling something for $10 on Tindy. It's same thing, right? It's just not worth your time.
I mean, one thing I feel kind of bad. I mean, like it had some design. You know, this also kind of got to the core of my like being, right? So like, you know, it was this cute little. It's like literally 555 circuit, and I sold it for $20 because of the trouble that it was. And
of
people,
course. Yeah,
like, some people paid for it. It was like a little add-on thing, as a little knickknack, collectible, whatever. There's a kit. I felt kind of bad about it. Like obviously the material cost was not. You know, it's like it's always that hardware brain thing. You know, like you're like looking at it, you're like there's no more than like $3 in parts here if you count like the, you know, you amortize all the shipping costs, the PCBs and whatever, and like maybe then you even maybe get up to $5-6 with my time, but. The real thing is you have to be like, shut up, hardware brain, engage business brain. It's like, is someone willing to pay $20 for a knickknack? And yes, they are. Right. I mean, like, and it's just, it's just one of those struggles that like those two parts of my brain really don't like each other. And you really have to shut down the hardware part of your brain if you want to stay in business. Right. I mean, like not that I'm staying in business.
Course.
It's just that it just reminded me of that tension of like, not what it costs. It's what it's worth.
Yeah.
That's, you know, for all the people that are considering doing this.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I've got like a fight, like, you know, now I sell meters, right? I sell multimeters.
Sure.
And, you know, if I get the occasional one that's return failed, right? Do I bother even claiming that under warranty from Bryman or from Kane Test? No, I don't bother. I just eat the cost. It's just not worth, you know, like, but now I'm actually getting quite a few. I don't know what it is. There's something in the water. There's at the fab plants, and I'm getting quite a significant number of meter failures these days, so they're actually building up. I'm staring at a pile now, so I'm thinking it's getting to the point where I might have to actually claim them under warranty. It's, you know, the first time in eight years or whatever. The actual factory warranty.
Yeah,
because I just buy and sell so many of them, it's just not worth claiming one, from the factory.
Yeah.
It's not. Yeah. Hmm. So
the thing that's, I think, different there, though, like, so like you are selling a thing that has, well, actually, I don't even know, like your meters have comparable, they at least have like comparable things that are out there. Right. So you're selling a value add either because of your endorsement or, you know, you have
because it's
a
blue instead of red. Right. And
sure.
It has my label on it. You can buy the exact, well, you can, some of the meters, you can buy the exact same meter somewhere else. Right, with the red Bryman logo,
Right, and so at that point, like, you have a supplier, obviously, you're just, you know, you're charging the, almost like the retail difference there, and then, like, but the price is basically set by the market, right? It's like, you know, the most
you can get
for the market, but I think there's a little bit of a difference when it's like you're selling something new for the first time, I feel like I'm always inclined to sell something lower than what I probably should, right? Especially when it's
to get a market. Yeah. Of course.
So like probably more like your what's your current thing? The microcurrent thing, right? At the time it was not completely unique in the market, but it was at least standalone enough that you had some like market power there, you know, and you could set a higher price than
I
the cost.
I could have, yeah, but I didn't. Yeah. And I sold a kit version, which was, you know, required a lot of time and effort, but I figured some people want a kit and it's good because they can save some money for people who don't have much money. Mm-hmm. They can build it cheaper, you know, et cetera. Yeah. So I went to that effort to actually stock and kit these up and sell them and support them and, you know,
Right, but that was a choice because of, I'm just saying, like, when you are, like, entering a market as, like, a product maker, it's, like, a whole different thing than, like, as a designer, I feel like.
Oh, yeah, no, you know totally. Yeah. Yeah. But I suck as a businessman, you know, like, I absolutely
me too, right?
Suck, right?
Selling $20 circuit boards on Tindy. Exactly, I mean, like, I'm not the totally paragon of business here, yeah,
that's right, like, yeah. You know.
But, yeah, I think just for people listening, you know, like, learn from our mistakes, it's like, the price is not, like, there are no immutable rules, it's, you know, like, we always talk about, like, 4x, the hardware cost is like a guideline, but really, the thing you should be charging is, like, you want to like basically figure out what is the maximum you can, you know, if you look at like economics, you want to like maximize the price versus how many you can sell. And you should like modulate the price until you hit that, you know, you figure out that curve that, and then you hit the maximum point on that curve. That's kind of the
change based on market dynamics. Like if it's a recession at the moment and everyone's, feeling the pitch, your sales drop, you know, going through the roof at the moment for some reason.
Really?
I don't know why. I just shipped 11 meters this morning overseas. They're sitting out the front waiting to be picked up.
Maybe exchange rate?
That's just in one day. Sorry?
Y'all have some cheap exchange rates right now. You know?
I don't. Well, yeah, that's another
bargain
bloody
based
problem.
Aussie buck.
Oh, don't get me started on bloody Shopify. I'm trying to set up a Shopify store at the moment, and it's traumatic.
Yeah.
Anyway, yes, the exchange rate is a real problem in trying and shipping rates.
Sure.
And, oh God.
Right. All that.
Yeah,
stuff.
I'm going through that ordeal at the moment. I just did a rant video about that. Speaking about production bomb costs. I just did a teardown video of the new Rigol DHO 800 scope.
I did.
Okay, excellent. Right, and you no
that
doubt saw
the fan heatsink was super interesting. Like that.
I am doing. I've got a live test running right now. I've actually disconnected the fan, and it's currently at 70 degrees. Holy crap! So if the fire alarm goes off.
Oh my.
You know that my DHO 800 has caught a light, and I'm going to have to evacuate the building, and I'll get charged $1,800 by the fire brigade. So, I'm stress testing it with no fan at the moment.
What is it? So, like, what is the heat sinking on? I saw that
it's on the FPGA. It's on the Zynq FPGA.
Oh,
it's on the analog to digital, the 12-bit analog to digital converter, which is a custom ASIC jobby, a custom Rigol jobby, and the custom analog front end chips.
Okay, so all those things, but not the ROC chip. I saw you said it's running Android.
That doesn't have a. Actually, is it the ROC chip as well? It might be. It might be the ROC chip processor as well. I'm not. Okay.
So they're just trying
to
draw all the heat away, basically.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
And you measured the power as well, right?
Basically, all of the major parts on that board, they decide, for those who haven't seen it, it's basically one big heatsink, which then has little machine protrusions which go down on the top of each chip. So it's one giant heatsink that covers the whole board, basically.
Oh, that's not machined, is it? It looks like it's poured.
It's machine. Well, I don't
like
know, cast, whatever.
Magnesium. Yeah, it looks like cast magnesium or something like that. Or
right.
Aluminum, maybe? I don't know. It's a cool shape, though. It's an interesting,
concept. Yeah, it's nice. And
are you going to put the heatsink back on and try and get that temperature when the heatsink's back on?
Well, no, sorry. The heatsink's on at the moment. Just the fan is not on, right?
Oh, wow.
So, yes. Okay. So the heatsink's on. No, I wouldn't run it without the, I'm sure the dies are, you know, so there's no fan, right? So I'm currently running it with
just
no fan. So it's getting, the heatsink's at 70. So I wonder what the die temps are at.
Oof.
Anyway, so I am stress testing it during this episode and I'll shoot a video right after we finish here.
Yeah.
I already shot the before with the fan and it was a 40 degrees and now it's at 70. So, oops.
So that fan's doing some work, huh? Yeah.
The fan's doing the tiny little fan and everyone's talking about it on the forum. Oh, people are obsessed with fans. This is why Rode and Schwartz in their new scope, they put in the super duper silent, mega awesome fan in it. Like, it's just like you don't even know it's got a fan. It's just, oh my God, it's like top of the range, you know, super silent design with rubber compliant mounts and everything. Get that sound out. So
yeah, I guess the scope is the kind of thing you're keeping on most of the time.
You're keeping on for the whole day. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, so anyway.
Yeah. Are you going to try and get some like CFD, computational fluid dynamics person? You're going to try and talk to someone like that? That'd be interesting.
Yeah, it would. But anyway.
I always wonder about that. Like, I remember, I guess the only time I really dealt with that was at Keithley when I worked there. They did some like CFD, you know, simulations. I've seen some, obviously some SolidWorks and other, all of the CAD programs want to talk about it, but I've never actually had any designs that have needed it because I usually don't like operate that close to the edge because I'm not. I'm making $20 555 timer boards, Dave.
No
heat sinks on those.
No, you can do some basic calculations, what you need, and you over-engineer it a little bit, and you put some airflow on it, and Bob's your uncle, right? And then you do some real-world testing on it, and you take temperature measurements. Yeah, we're well in the ballpark. We've got lots of margin.
Please don't go above 40 C in your ambient and you'll be fine.
Oh boy. I just did some, the fanboy, the heatsink fanboys.
The fanboys?
I just did a video because my computer failed, right? On the machine I'm using at the moment to render all my videos. It finally failed after a couple of years. It was shutting down when I was rendering my videos. And it turns out that my heatsink compound had failed. The government's shutting me down.
No. Actually, your computer doesn't like it. It's just like,
it's sentient. Okay,
Again with a rant video. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you bought too many GPUs, and there you go.
Right. You know, it's become sentient. Like,
yep, there you go.
Anyway. So it turns out, I had a combination of bad paste. It had just dried out over the years,
Yep.
And so I repasted it, and that fixed that. So it got better, but it still happened once. So I looked at it again, and it was the way my fan was mounted. I got a 10 degree C differential in temperature just by relocating my fan to the other side of the heatsink.
Wow. Okay.
Because it's all about the inlet temperature. So it's currently mounted on the top of the case, which pulls cold air. I've got vents on the top of the case, so it pulls the ambient office air here in instead of blasting it out, and from the and the GPU cards nearby. So it was basically the inlet temperature of the fan, and a lot of people didn't believe me. I shot this video, and that was my theory, and a lot of people didn't believe me, so I had to actually do another follow-up video proving that was the case, and I got a 10 degree C differential, and everyone's going, whoa, okay, that's new. Haven't seen that before.
Hold my beer. Somebody's wrong in the internet.
Well, it's apparently because that is the prevailing wisdom in the computer, business, the Linus Tech Tips, gamers, Nexus industry, is that fan placement doesn't make that much of a difference. You might get a couple of degree difference, but no, you've got to take individual circumstances into account. And I could physically feel with my hand at least a 10 degree C differential on the inlet temp based on the location of the fan. So I went, it absolutely must make a differential if I change that fan to the other side. And sure enough, it did. Oh, basic engineering for the win,
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, I could physically feel it with my hand. I knew it would make a large difference, and it did. So
no more shutdowns then?
No more shutdowns yet. No, my temp's now running, even rendering flat out, it's under 65 degrees, I think. It's good. Okay.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was very interesting. But it actually required me to do a video testing it to prove it to people that it made that much larger of a difference. People just didn't believe it. So anyway.
I haven't built like a, is it like a desktop rig?
It's a home-built desktop rig. Yeah.
I haven't done that in a long time. And I feel like I should. Like some people like when they, I'm screen sharing with coworkers, things like that, they're like, your stuff is compiling really slow. And I'm like, and they're like, well, and then they show me what they have on their desktop. And I'm like, holy crap. like sometimes just the compilation times, and it does add up, if you're doing a lot of code, I suppose, but which I'm not.
All right.
But it makes me wonder if I should have like a, what do they call that? Like a front end, back end kind of thing. And that's not what it's called. Like a server and thin client. thin client model, right? That kind of idea.
Yeah. So people tell me to do that. Oh, why don't you have a gigantic, big render server rack in your bunker? You know, like have a giant, you know, you've got all these dumpster PCs. You can set them up as a cluster and you can do mass rendering. It's like, oh, bloody hell. No, that's just insane.
I just buy a thin client style PC just for like taking to trade shows and stuff like that, because they're just insanely cheap, you know.
You're right.
And like the specs seem good. I don't know. It'll be here tomorrow. We'll see how it comes up. But like having another box to just kind of throw in a bag, you know, like instead of a laptop, it's like let's test my metricing, Dave. Let's see.
Yeah, right. Hang on, temperature's dropping. My temperature. I fear something terrible has happened. As if a million
horses have cried out,
and they were suddenly silenced. Yeah, hang on, I'm going to go check. Hang on.
All right. Oh my God, he's going to shoot a quick video. Editor.
There we go. Sorry, just had to shoot a video.
Well, we made it. We made it into the video. We got to mention.
Did make it into the video. Everyone, you're welcome. Yep. The scope has crashed and it's stuck on the boot screen and it doesn't smell that good. So I hope I haven't killed it. I just disconnected the power. Yeah. Oh, wow. It's just this tiny little fan, like as a little, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, as small as they get, it makes a huge, huge difference. So looks like this one's not going to be passively cooled, I'm afraid. Looks like you need the fan in there to keep it. Well, that was that was why I tested it, you know, stress test. It still air is the worst. Like, you know, like even having a little bit of airflow, even from your aircon, right? Even from your aircon on your roof, that's just, you know, gently blowing air just around the room. At least there's some movement which can go through the vents on your case, right?
And I know all about dead air, Dave, because you just walked away from your microphone.
Right. Yes, exactly. Well, you know, what do you want me to do? Anyway,
I don't know. You said you were going to wait until it started on fire. I didn't hear anything about fires.
Oh, well, you know, I'm not going. It's going to cost me $1,800, dude. That fire alarm goes off.
Oh, fire alarm. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. I don't know if that's the thing here. So if you set it off, it's $1,800.
If I set it off, or it just goes off.
I guess it makes sense that there's like externalities. Yeah.
Yeah, every office has its own individual sensor, which goes back to a monitored control panel, and our building, i.e. me, the owners, we all pay for the fire brigade and the alarm automatically goes back to the local fire brigade, and as soon as the sensor goes off, boom, they're straight here. So and then they come to the panel in the basement. First thing they do is come to the panel in the foyer, and they go, okay, which unit went off? who burnt the toast this time? And and you get a bill for $1,800 for calling out the fire brigade.
It's not a bad idea. It's just
It's a bit, but we deliberately pay for that service because if there is a real fire, we want them to come as quickly as possible, right? So we have to sort of eat that cost.
Yeah.
Sort of like in, you know, hopefully a real fire doesn't happen, but if it does, it basically they get notified like instantly. So it isn't like somebody has to call them up and it's got to go through the, you know, emergency services number and blah, 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 right? So, yeah. Mm. So if we didn't have that, then it would require someone to phone it in, right? It'd require a building's on fire and they turn up. No, it's not, but, you know. So we choose to do that. I think it might even be it might even be council regulations, perhaps, for buildings over a certain size. Don't quote me on that, but that wouldn't surprise me. Anyway, cool. It's pricey. I know many who've had an expensive breakfast burning their toast in this building. Let me tell you.
That's funny.
Yep. Yeah.
Speaking of burning things up, I am thinking about... This is a terrible segue. I am thinking about burning up some routing bits at a PCB manufacturer, and I was wondering about your input on this.
Yeah, standard routing bit, 2.4 millimeters. Yeah.
Have you ever done controlled depth routing at a PCB house?
Yes, we have.
What have you done it for?
Oh, it's basically for very form, low form factor stuff where you have to embed stuff into the PCB so they don't stick out in certain locations where you have to get a form factor thing. So, yep. You can, they will do anything you want.
Yeah. I have a display and I'm thinking about having like a, it's basically like reverse mounted. And right now it's held down with very copious amounts of hot glue. And I'm thinking about not doing that and instead having it like seated in the back of like a PCB display, PCB that I'm making. And I've never done controlled depth routing before. So it would be nice to have that there, but then I don't know, like ideas on like cost adders or anything like that. I mean, like,
I'm not sure what the current cost is, but there are two ways to do it. One, you don't actually have to do control depth routing after the fact because control depth routing is done once all your layers are bonded together, right? So if you've got a multi-layer board, a 4 or an 8 layer, they will manufacture those layers separately and they'll stick them together, right? They'll actually adhesive bond the layers together. So you can actually, at the point of where you're doing, say you wanted the two outer layers or something and you wanted a control depth thing, they can actually fully route that board before they then stick them on.
All together. And, right, that's a good idea.
Yeah. And then you get like a sharper cutout. You get a perfectly sharp cutout, whereas the controlled depth ones, depending on the routing bit they use, some can be like a physical drill with like a tapered drill, but others can be like a flat ended bit,
a mill bit.
An actual mill bit. Yeah. You know, but so there's several ways that they can do it. But it's generally, you will not get a like a shared panel. They won't do that on like a low cost shared
the
panel service.
Stuff. I think that's the real thing that it comes down to is like, I'm going to have to either get enough volume or. Yeah, I'm just going to have to eat it on that sort of thing.
Or you can get two different boards made and then you stick them together yourself.
Oh, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah. You can certainly do it the El Cheapo way.
Yeah, and I guess you could like do like a little sandwich, like the sandwich.
What we talked about the other week, the boombox.
Joe
Grand's boombox, right? I actually after that, I watched the full video of him. And he gave a talk as well. There's a video of where he gave a talk about how he's manufacturing the board and everything. So I can find that and we can link that down below. But I watched that as well, and that was interesting. And but I couldn't help but think, geez, I would have done it the real cheap way and actually just manufactured two separate boards and just stuck them together. Like the whole controlled depth route into, you know, do all these large cutouts and cut the individual LEDs in there and cut like, you know.
Oh, that's right. Because he did that to get like the diffuse effect, like through he was backfiring through the board, right?
Yeah. He was doing all the advanced techniques, and I'm going, that's fantastic. But, it cost some coin.
Yeah, I think he was working with a PCB house that wanted to showcase that stuff too.
Oh, did he? Okay, right.
Yeah,
right.
Remembering how he did that stuff because he did. I think on one of those videos he showcased one of the US-based manufacturers.
Oh, that's right. Yes, he did. And then he's, yes, that's right. He was showcasing the manufacturer, so they probably did it for Nix, but that would cost him a lot. And he did an 8-color silkscreen pass, so he did 8 different passes on the silkscreen, you know, and custom dye colors to boot, right? So he actually got the Pantone match colors that he wanted, and they mixed 8 different custom Pantone color mixes for him for the silkscreen. Holy crap.
Right.
I think company,
PCB
houses, it was a showcase.
Take on the don't say no, just quote them a price, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, they were really showcasing their capabilities there. They were pushing their capabilities to the max just to showcase it. But if you can go to them and get that same thing, but just be prepared to pay probably $4,000 for a one board.
Right.
I am not kidding. Right. No, it was not uncommon for us to get a board. And granted, we got it turned in 24 hours, but we were paying $2,000 plus for a prototype board. US.
Yeah, I think it is I've been dealing with people that are having some jarring experiences themselves moving from I've been talking to people that are like moving from Arduino to Zephyr and that is very jarring, right?
Yes.
For a couple of reasons. And then I think moving from, I actually had this when I was doing, I got quoted like a normal PCB process in the US recently. And I'm like, what? I can get these so cheap from China and whatever. And it's exactly. Like, yeah, you can, but that's not on the menu right now, Chris. Like, and then it's like, oh, okay. Yeah. So that's just the price then. Okay. You know, like that's just deal with it, you know? Okay. Yep. So,
and was it a shared service or were you paying for your own panel?
It was, I was going to get the panel,
Oh, yeah, you were going to get that. Yeah, that instantly, right? When I was a boy, there was no shared service. You had to pay $500 to $800 minimum, and you got the whole panel. So you bloody well took advantage of that. You went, I've got to buy a panel, especially at work. This was fun at work, you know. You knew you had to pay for the panel, so you throw all your own designs on there because you were going to waste the panel anyway.
Yeah, so, right, you know, right, exactly. Yeah, get people to chuck in. I mean, that's basically how shared services worked or started.
Yeah, basically, it was a do-it-yourself shared service, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
whereas now it's all totally automated with the whole back end. People upload their boards and the software automatically just joins them together and whacks them in and, you know?
Yep.
But
did you happen to see, I guess it's not on our list because we didn't add it. But Scotty from Strange Parts, he went back to JLC.
Oh, I haven't seen. I've seen that the video's there. Yeah, and he went. Yeah, they've got great. 80 lines or something.
It's insane. Yeah, 80 production lines.
I haven't seen it. Yeah, but I can imagine. Yeah, it's enormous. Yeah. Like I've been to ones that have 16 lines or something, you know. But 80, like, what?
Yeah, I mean, it just boggles the mind. You know, like just. Yeah.
For those who don't know, a line, when we're talking about a production line at a PCB assembly house, this is not a this is not a bare board manufacturer.
No, this was this was the thing he went to was a Flex PCB manufacturer. So it was Flex.
Oh, it was a Flex PCB manufacturer. Yeah, right, oh, okay. Right. Anyway, so line will mean the same thing, actually.
Yeah, that's right.
In both cases. In the case of an assembly house, which is assembling the components on your board with the pick and place machines, a line is it literally is a row of pick and place machines with the conveyor belt, but it's the auto stenciling machine, for example, the auto paste machine, and then the pick and place machine, then the reflow machine, and then the optical inspection machine, and then the bed of nails inspection machine, and they're all literally in a conveyor belt line, and your board just goes, travels on the conveyor belt. That's why if you're designing a panel, a PCB panel for any sort of production, you need the holes on the outer edge of the board so it can go into the sprockets that then can shoot your board along the conveyor belt and or can actually align your board into the spigots for the bed of nails, you know, tester, so it can get accurate alignment and all that sort of jazz. So there are certain requirements, there are certain standards for the strip along the outer edge of your board, which has to go through the rails on those lines. So anyway. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That's beyond the scope of this. On the scope of an amp hour episode.
I think it's still relevant though. Like it is like, you know, I think in a most efficient processes are going to have, you know, just everything just flows through, right? Anything that stops
it just flows through without stopping. Anything that stops the line, big red lights, strobe lights flash when the line stops.
People start running.
People start running.
I think the most impressive piece of equipment that was on there is they said like, so when they're doing, I think it was, must have been photoresist. Instead of doing like exposure, like straight down through a transparency, like how many of our PCBs are still made.
Yeah.
They have it like where they're doing a line raster across. Yes. And as the board flows through at a constant rate, it's basically like a laser cutter, but it's just lasering off.
Yes.
You know, just that one line. And as it passes through, it's nuts. I mean, that
crazy. Okay. I definitely have to watch that video. Yeah.
Oh, it's so good. I mean, like, JLC paid for it, right? So like, there's no hiding that fact, right?
And they've invited me to go over there, you know, and they'll host me and they'll take me through the production, the whole facility.
I'm sure the scale would be, fantastic.
Oh yeah, it's absolutely mind-blowing, yep.
But yeah, that one machine really blew my mind.
Yeah.
Especially because like you think about, I mean, like even there are these, not needing custom tooling, right? I think about like when you have tooling involved, the kind of the NRE cost goes up, right? So you are getting a stencil made, that's some flat cost because someone has to go and cut out or etch out your stainless steel stencil. And that is like a fixed cost for your build.
And for those who don't know, it isn't just the stencil, then they have to frame it because these automated paste machines have to have a big frame. They have to have a big metal alloy frame on them going around the outside so it doesn't warp and so it sits in the machine properly and, you know,
that's right,
et cetera. Yeah. Cost money.
And so you have that kind of like fixed cost, but then you start to have tooling that has removed it. And so like in the solder paste example, right, there are these like automated stenciling machines, but even those, they're like basically like inkjet printers for solder paste, which is awesome. Those still aren't that same like linear kind of way.
They aren't as fast. They're usually for prototype things. Yeah. Usually for the high volume production stuff, they have the big squeegee. It's an automated squeegee that goes in the, you know, it's totally automated, but it's a big squeegee because you can do it all instantly. So
yeah, just think about like process standardization and stuff like that. So something like that laser machine was really, it really blew my mind. I mean, like, I had not seen anything like that. Of course that kind of stuff exists, but man, that was cool.
Yep.
So.
Yes. Good stuff.
I don't really have any need for flex PCBs, and they're expensive. They're still even with like
are
low
they?
Cost like JCBs.
I don't think. They are.
They're way cheaper than they used to be. Don't get me wrong.
Oh yeah, no, totally.
But like, you know, when you compare them to like FR4.
Well, what is your idea of expensive?
Oh, that's a good question.
Like, is it $50? Is it $500? Is it, you know? I thought they were low cost flex services these days.
Oh, there are. Yeah. I mean, like, but like unit cost.
I got a flex PCB a couple of years back and it didn't cost much at all. But it was literally just like a little two layer like
one sided
flex.
Yeah,
and it was an inch by an inch. It was just like a, we were doing a mod on the board. Oh, okay. So it was like a little, so it was just like single chip sort of modded out to, you know, something else. It cost dollars or something. It wasn't much. It was really cheap.
I think you're probably right. I mean, like, I think I was comparing it to equivalent FR4, you know, size, and that's not a fair comparison. But I was working on a consulting project for a wearable that had like a bunch of LEDs on it basically. And so like a big matrix of LEDs, and it was on flex, and it had curvature to it. And it was not cheap, you know.
Okay. All right.
But probably like $5-6 for a PCB, but like in decent volume, you know, like a couple hundred volumes still. Now, it wasn't, I didn't see the drop off either, right?
Okay.
So
right.
That was the other thing. All
right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it depends on size. It depends on all sorts of things, whether or not it's just flex on its own, whether or not it's rigid flex, whether it, once again, it's got, you know, tiny micro vias on it and, you know, all sorts
of
things.
Sure, exactly. Yeah. Right? Like what the process nodes are.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah,
I don't really have any need for that stuff, and currently, and you know, someday maybe.
All right,
but not currently. I feel like you need to have like fancy plastics that have curves on them, and I currently don't do that.
Got it. Well, I was going to speak when I was talking about the scope before, and I was actually going to get into the production assembly side of things.
Yeah. Okay.
Because in that teardown, you no doubt saw that I was a bit flabbergasted that there's two chips missing in there, right? Which is for the extra memory for the logic analyzer option, which is not even available in this model, right? So it's not available in this model at all. Yet they physically removed the chips, obviously, right, to save cost.
Sure.
But then they left in all of the bypass caps and all of the termination resistors. And I'm not just talking one bypass cap. I'm talking like 20 bypass caps and 20 termination resistors. It's like, why? And then somebody on the forum, of course, in the comments. What?
Let me guess first.
Yep, go.
I think it actually relates to what we were talking about earlier with lines. I would guess that they go through two lines and they're completely, they're separate, but you just put them through because the cost differential for retooling
so little.
Line,
yeah,
is so little. It's, you were right. It was not zero. It's not zero to have those caps on there, but is the cost difference, like maybe it's even at the point, I can imagine a high enough volume is the word. Yes. Thank you. Yes.
That
I do
it
electronics.
Matters. Yes. That actual
time. Even you ship it between buildings.
Yeah. Time handling rack space, because if you've got two different models of boards, they have to be individual. They have to have their own individual rack space, their own individual, you know, handling and everything else. So the handle of the board. But that's not the thing that one of the people on the one of the people in the comments mentioned. They mentioned, oh no, it's for an EMC thing. They've got to have the termination resistors on there so that the lines don't radiate and stuff like that. And got to have the bypass caps on there. And went, which is a reasonable comment, but the bypass caps aren't going to matter a rat's ass, okay?
No.
And the termination resistor. Yeah, of course. But if you're dumb enough to make a model that then radiates into dead lines, like you couldn't even turn that off in firmware.
Right, you have a firmware thing and you don't send stuff to the memory area.
To the memory area when we know the memory's not fitted. I mean, that's just ludicrous. Sure. Right. So, I think it must be, as you said, it must be a cost trade-off handling, you know, like factory, you know, issue.
Yeah.
So it's just easier for them to leave them on. Right. Yep. But of course, you wouldn't want to populate the expensive chip, so you would leave that off. Yep. Right. But the caps and the resistors.
Given our relatively recent bubblegum tap shoe history here, Dave, you don't actually know if they just couldn't get the chips.
Right. Okay. Yes.
Happened on a dev board I saw recently where all the documentation said, yeah, there's an accelerometer right there. And it's just not there. And the thing from the shortage, I think. Yeah.
Right.
And it's like, you know,
it's real.
It's hard to like get this across to people that haven't done hardware. I don't have a good way to say it, but like the best I've come up with is you have to be perfect. You at least have to have everything in stock. One part will hold up an entire production line. Yeah, and I feel like that doesn't really get through to people. But like that idea, it'll just blow up. It'll ruin your weekend. It'll ruin your month. You know, like
it can ruin your career.
Yeah, it'll ruin your career. Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, if you promise something, right?
Yeah, of course. Oh yeah, no, definitely. Oh, you know, manager comes in. Are these boards going to ship next month? Oh yeah, no problem whatsoever. Everything's sorted, and then one part doesn't come through, and you are. Yeah. And you can't get an alternative for it because you didn't plan for it, then you're screwed. Yeah. It's
totally screwed. Yep.
Yep. Yep. Sometimes you have to quickly do a bodge board or something to use a different part, like a totally different footprint, you know? Like, So,
yikes. What a nightmare.
Yeah. Anyway.
I wonder how many careers have ended because of the shortage.
Right. You know, like, oh, well, yeah, I'm sure.
You know, there's like the ones who are like, you're fired.
I know people.
And then there's,
I know several people who made, like, you know, they were selling boards on Tindy, they were doing stuff, went, no, I am done. I'm done. I cannot get these parts. I'm shutting down. I'm not going to be in this business anymore. I'm done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was thinking how many people who said, you know, present company included, who said, you know what, maybe I should do hard or software for a couple of years.
Right. Oh, boy.
Yep. You know, Dave, the good old days, you know, like 2022 where you'd cut your wrist for an STM32 part, you know.
Right. Yeah, of course. Oh boy. And that was one of the reasons that I didn't go ahead with the microcurrent at the time. The micro supply. At the time, I've done a recent video on showing where the micro supply got to and everything. That was one of the reasons, you know, is that COVID had just started and the supply chain crisis had just started and I used two different STM32 micros on there. It's like, you know.
That's a rough go, man. That's a rough go.
I don't want any of this pain, you know. That fed into the equation of why I went, no, I've got no enthusiasm to do this. No, I just don't want the fight. No.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, and I was asking, so Scott Williams was back on, a fellow Aussie of yours. He was on last week. And I was asking him about like standard parts and, you know, like what they start with. And they all make sense. But like, so he said like ESP32 for Wi-Fi, NRF52 for Bluetooth. And I'm like nodding my head. And he's like, STM32 otherwise. I'm like, ooh.
Yeah, right. Nice.
But that is totally a good suggestion, right? Like, up until 2 years ago, it was a great suggestion, and now it's probably a good suggestion again. You know, maybe deal with a GD32 or a RV2032 or all the ones that are like cloning these things, right? But the fact that there's clones is pretty good too. So,
Oh boy, yeah. It just and it could come back. Like, all this drama could come back. I mean, China's in a spot of bother at the moment, and and the political tensions and everything happening. Sure. You know, I wouldn't rule out. Yeah, I would not be betting anything on China at the moment. I would not know. If you are reliant upon China at the moment, you could kamikaze.
Yeah. Just so be careful. This is an interesting thing, again, that didn't get posted to the subreddit because I'm lazy. Just came up today. But there was a news article about Intel. It was on Tom's Hardware. I'll send it to Dave here at least. Intel announces ARM investment, talks up RISC-V. And I read that, and I'm like, in my head, what I'm thinking is Coca-Cola announces Pepsi investment, talks up RC Cola.
I know. That's that was my first.
Just like the words don't go together, right? You know, exactly. Like, just like what?
Exactly.
And then you dig into a little bit, and like it's like okay. So Intel Foundry Group actually talks ARM investment and talks up RISC-V because the Foundry Group doesn't give a crap if you're using x86. They're just making as many chips as they can, right? Yes. We've talked about this on the show many times before.
Right.
I'm just like,
it's the fab. You know, the Foundry Group is the fab, and they will make your chips if you're a big enough player.
I got enough money. Who cares?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right? Bring it on, man. Yeah. So. Yeah, it's quite, but it's just like that stuff is,
it's funny.
It is interesting when Intel and all these are like, who was the other one? RISC-V. There was another RISC-V thing where I think it was a couple weeks ago when we were talking about it. Qualcomm. Qualcomm invests in RISC-V too. And it's just like, okay. All right. Yeah. Like and some of it just feels like it's kind of like, well, we're at the cool kid table now, you know, like RISC-V is like the new hot thing and we need to recruit around here too. But like, it just, you know, like these walled gardens based on, you know, they're building companies based on being walled gardens on their own thing. It's like, are you guys are here? Okay. All right. It's that kind of party. All right.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
Yep. Could we circle back to the niche product market again? Sure. You know, the niche Tindy thing? Because I just did it's not really related to Tindy, related to eBay, actually.
Okay.
In that I just
talked about eBay last time, too, right?
Huh?
We talked about eBay, our last episode, you and I recording. Yes. Remember we talked about buying power modules on there, things like that?
Yep. Well, here it is again, right? I was repairing a Agilent/Keysight U1273A meter, right? And it's got this OLED screen. And this OLED screen so famously fails, right, in these meters that somebody, presumably in China, somebody in China, they've gone to the effort, not only, like, because you can't really buy the OLED anymore, but you really, even if you could, you really wouldn't bother because it's got some manufacturing defect that fails in all these meters. Apparently all these Agilent Keysight, well, you know, not all, but... there's enough of them that have failed out there. It's so infamous for it that somebody went to the effort to reverse engineer the OLED protocol, which isn't hard if you got the data sheet and everything else, right? It's not massive, but you know, somebody went to the effort to redo this, and then they used an STM32 micro to drive to then interpret the signals coming from the meter, which expects to talk to one OLED, and then they translate the protocol to drive a different OLED screen, which you can actually buy.
Wow.
And yeah, they went to that effort and they sell lots of them on that. Well, I they bet, sell, yeah. And you know, they sell hundreds of these things because
that's
there's, you know, hundreds
individual.
Or thousands.
That's
yeah,
great.
Exactly. Yeah, somebody went, somebody spent like a week actually
show,
designing this board, right? Oh,
that's,
okay.
That's,
no,
that's
they're probably in China
product.
And they probably don't speak English.
Who cares?
But,
well,
you know,
okay,
they right, found you know. A niche, right? They just found this niche and went, I'm going to do this, damn it. And sure enough, you know, there's this one source for this.
Here we go. How much they charge for that kit?
Oh, like, it was expensive. It was $80 US.
All right. You see?
Yeah, it was a lot of money, right?
It was probably $5 in parts.
Exactly.
But like, you know, it's IP in
the
there.
The OLED screen is, which I couldn't find info on. So it's probably like, I don't know, they got some bulk lot somewhere.
Yeah, they know,
you
somebody.
Know?
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Or maybe, you know, they got them for 10 cents a pop because they were surplus or something. And they designed this board, which just has an STM micro on it and a little converter to boost the voltage up a little bit.
Yeah.
And it was $80 US.
Wow. Right?
Yeah. But you're so desperate to fix your $500 meter that you'll pay the $80 for the board.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
Perfectly priced. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
I was looking at one of the e-ink screens that was on my desk today, and I was shocked that it was a 2017 date code. And my coworker said, well, of course it is. Like, we're buying them one at a time. Like, they're not, like, making a fresh batch for you, Chris. It's like, oh yeah, right.
Right.
Oh, boy. But, like, yeah. You know, you just never know when you're buying. You know, I'm buying on AliExpress, whatever, like, just buying onesies-twosies, you know, like, That's not how production works. And there's not enough volume that it's moving where, yeah, like 2017 is, yeah, it's
cool.
6 years ago, right?
Yep. Yeah, it's not uncommon to get old stock of stuff, you know? Yep.
Yeah.
Well, even when I opened up that Rigol scope, the ASIC front end, I think, had a date code from a couple of years back. So obviously, when they designed that ASIC, they ordered a million of the bloody things, and they're still using them, right?
Yeah, working
Right.
See, what's interesting about the ASIC was 12-bit, but
it's a 12-bit analog to digital converter. I think it's a custom Rigol, or they might have teamed up with somebody to do it.
Sure.
Yeah, somebody mentioned that on the forum.
TI or
Yeah, they teamed up with TI or AD or something. You know.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. Is like. So, like, many years ago, they weren't selling 12-bit scopes, were they? Or
No. This is a new thing. Well, it started 12 months ago. They did their first 12-bit scope, which was the 4000 series. And then it went down to the 1000 series.
Well, then how does the date code match up, though? But that's what I mean. Is like, if the date code is from a couple years ago, when they weren't selling 12-bit scopes, then it probably...
Well, it takes a while to design those things.
Sure. No doubt. Right? Yeah, no doubt.
So they obviously made them. They designed it a year. It would have been designed and made like a year before that scope was released, right?
Sure. But
so
what was the date code? You said...
I'm just ballparking. It was don't remember. It was like a year or two ago, right?
Oh, okay.
But yeah,
okay. So it, wasn't
it
like
certainly was not
ago,
a new though. Part. It was not a new
Got
part,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So even though this is a brand new scope straight off the production line, it used this custom ASIC chip from a couple of years ago. Yeah. So, you know.
Okay. Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. I talked to one of the designers on an Agilent scope at one point. Was it Agilent? Maybe it was a Techscope. I don't know. But they were using like really old silicon, like because they were using like super fancy processes too. And like I had met, I forget, I must have met him back in my test and measurement days.
Well, Tech are famously still using the ASIC from 30 years ago.
Hmm. Oh, really?
Yeah, like, and well,
I don't
know
if they,
or they had just stopped. Yeah, it was the any tech scope that has 2K of sample memory, it is using the 30-year-old ASIC in it.
Oh, interesting.
Right, it is using. They milked that thing for at least 25 years. I think they milked ASIC. Yeah,
and like, would they? Was it like the same thing where they batched up the chips, and or is it like they just kept making the same?
I think they're all old stock. Actually, yeah, I've talked to Tech about this at one point, and they said, oh yeah, we've still got a lot of stock of that chip. We've still got a lot of stock. I don't think anyone makes it anymore. It's like they just ordered, like, you know, maybe the fab that they were using, there was some, like, it's not that all the chips are 30 years old or 20 years old or something, but maybe, you know, a decade ago the fab just went, no, we don't have this process node anymore.
Final run,
and Tech went, okay, we'll order a million of them, please, you know.
Yep.
Yeah. I don't know the exact number, but, you know.
They said there's a lot of those chips. At a fab, you know, like fabs always do like process node reductions and stuff like that too, where they might obviate an old process or something like that.
But then
it wouldn't be worth it for Tech to re-up and like then have to go revalidate
It was not worth spending any engineering effort and cost to actually redo that silicon because they've got newer, more advanced designs now. But they still want to sell that scope because there's still a market for it. So you just manufacture the old chip again.
Which scope was it? Which scope?
It started out as the TDS-210. The original TDS. Yeah, the original TDS-210.
Oh, I hated those things.
Oh, yeah, but that was groundbreaking, dude.
I know. We've talked about it on the show. No, I don't actually harbor any ill feelings against it. It was just that, like, I have negative associations with, like,
by modern standards.
No, my frustrating early days of electronics where I didn't know anything was going on.
Oh, okay, right.
I was using those things, and I was just like, what am I even looking at here?
Yeah. Right.
So
right.
It's a Chris problem. It's not an actual product problem.
And then it ended up being used in their 2000 series scope as well, and their 1000 series or something. Oh, yeah, it was used in their modern scopes up until... I don't know if they're technically still shipping it. Don't quote me, but even as little as 3-4 years ago, they were still shipping scopes with that chip in it.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It's crazy. Yeah, and then it went into their, and then they remarketed it as the TBS, the Tech Basics series, which was designed to, which is Tech's cheapest scope, which is like $300 or something, which they sell to like labs, school labs and things.
Yeah.
TBS 1000. It's still on their website. Yeah, I think you can buy a TBS 1000 series scope. Yeah, I think 1 gig sample per second. Yep, it's still the same. What's the sample memory? Yeah, like, you know, it's probably 2K or 4K. Yeah. Maybe they've used two chips in there.
Yeah, yeah. It probably wouldn't hold much of a
20K.
Candle.
20K. Oh, 20K. Yeah. How have they done that?
Yeah.
20K of sample memory. So that might be a variation on that ASIC or something, but it's still that ancient thing. And they're still milking it. You can still buy it.
Yeah.
I'll happily sell it to you. Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that. If there's a market to sell into, you just keep selling.
I mean, some people say that Tektronix tries to elongate the usefulness of their silicon, much like pioneers do with a 555 circuit on a gimmicky circuit board.
Hang on, don't
they're
just
kind of copying
single
my
out
model. That's what I'm trying
yeah,
to say.
Yeah, yeah, they're copying your model. Model. Okay, well, yeah. they're copying the best. I mean, but don't just single out Tektronix. Hey, Keysight, remember the Keysight MegaZoom 4 ASIC is now 14 years old.
Sure. Sure.
There has been no upgrade. They are still selling all of their current scopes. Use the MegaZoom 4 ASIC chip, the exact same ASIC chip with the exact same built-in 4 meg of memory. And there's nothing on the horizon. Yeah, 14 years. Like, that was one of the first videos I did was the release of the MegaZoom 4 ASIC. It's one of the first videos I did on my channel. And it was, I think it's 14 years now.
That's nuts.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nuts. Whereas I actually researched this at the maybe 5 years ago when I went, well, where's the MegaZoom 5 coming out? And on average, they had released a new MegaZoom 4 ASIC every 8 years. So they started out with the MegaZoom, then it was the MegaZoom 2, then the MegaZoom 3, and then the MegaZoom 4. And then,
four. Okay.
So it went 8, 8, 8, 8, and now it's 14. I don't know. Something's going on.
Sounds like they reached the top, Dave. They just can't. You can't improve perfection. Yeah.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. But once again, they still sell bucket loads of those scopes, right? And they're really great. And they're still one of the fastest things in the business, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's only very recently, 14 years later, that Rohde & Schwarz now beat them with 4 million waveform updates per second versus 1 million. You know, it's like it's only recently that somebody's actually beaten them.
So, maybe they're taking longer because they're doing the ultra zoom instead of the mega zoom. Maybe that's why.
Right.
You know, it's you know that every time they do a spin,
ultra zoom is a trademark. I think that's a trademark of Rigol.
Oh my God, it's terrible.
Which ironically, not supposed to tell you this, but Keysight helped Rigol in the early days, and rumor has it they might have regretted it.
Oh yeah, because didn't they rebadge the?
They rebadged it. So their engineers helped out Rigol back when Rigol were a nobody. And
I mean, that's how the innovator's dilemma goes, Dave.
Yeah, right. And I think Keysight might be regretting that association now because Rigol are doing their own custom ASICs. They're one of the big players now. So,
I mean, the thing. The low-end people always move up market, you know. I feel like there is no better place for that than car makers. I feel like anytime I see a low-cost car, I look at it and I'm like, in 20 years, if you survive 20 years, you are going to be a fancy car, right? Because because it's just, you know, they have to be efficient at the bottom end. And then if they can survive, then of course they start hiring more marketing. They have better designers. They, you know, they get a better brand name, whatever. Mm-hmm. And nuts. I guess car brands do a little more often though.
Right. Anyway, the scope makers are... Anyway, I think we do have a new... I haven't done my review video yet. I haven't shot it yet, but I suspect we have a new revolution in entry-level scopes. It started out with the Tektronix 210 series. Mm. They were the first to pioneer a digital entry-level bench real-time sampling scope. And then it was the Rigol with the 1052E. That was the one that Keysight helped them out with, the 1052E, and that became the new benchmark standard. And it was the benchmark standard for 7-8 years, maybe, until, you know, a couple of players like Sigalint came along and eventually gave better bang per buck. But there was no real revolution there. And then Rygol did it again with the 1054Z, which four channel scopes became the new entry level standard. Now, you're considered nuts if you buy a two channel entry level scope, right? It's just nuts, right?
You said that in your thing as well, like in your review, you said, why would you even bother with the two channel?
Why would you even buy? And why would you buy the two channel? They still make the two channel version, even of this new one.
What is the cost difference?
It's a $60 difference between two channel and four channel. And you get the two extra probes, right? I mean, sure, in volume, those probes cost $5 to make, right? But, you know, still, right? You know? Yeah. And, yeah, so it's a complete no-brainer, right? And that started with the Rygol 1054Z. And once again, Sigalint came out with a better bang per buck version, but it wasn't really revolutionary. And now Sigalint with the DHO 800 series for the same entry-level price of 389 Yankee bucks, you get 12-bit. Not only do you get four channels and 12-bit, so they've moved from four channels 8-bit to four channels 12-bit. Not only have they made that move, you also get HDMI out as standard, you get Visa mount as standard, you get USB-C power standard, whether you like that or not. That's a different question. You can do a whole episode arguing over that. And you get LAN, serial, decoding, everything built in, standard, and it's touchscreen, right? So the whole entry-level market has changed again.
I guess we really can have it all, huh, Dave?
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's a few shortcomings to it, I'm sure. But, geez, you know, like I think the entry-level scope landscape has changed again. So this is the fourth change that I see. Started with tech, then two Rygol, and then now third Rygol change. Mm. And the others will have to copy now. There's absolutely no choice.
You had mentioned that it's a Android...
It's an Android OS, yes.
Yeah, Android. Is there any downside to that or no? I don't really know what the other ones would be.
Not really. It's just meh. You know, I don't care. Like, does it care? You can play Doom on it, I guess, you know. Like,
yeah, right.
Right. And the other interesting thing is that you might have noticed it actually has an SD card in there containing the operating system.
That,
it's not built into the chip. And I've actually dumped that info from the SD card, so you can get that on my forum. And people on the forum have actually, very nerds who know about these sort of OS things, they actually verified, the entire OS is on the SD card. So once again, that's a deliberate change to it being on the physical chip soldered on the board. So whether or not they did that for cost saving, whether or not they did that for flexibility, don't know. Yeah. So, yeah. Anyway, it's certainly an interesting change. Landscape shifted again. Thanks, Rygol. This episode is not sponsored by Rygol.
It's not sponsored by Rygol, yeah.
No, but they just happen to be, you know, I just call it the way I see it. And, I think it's changed again. So, yeah, I'd sell your DS1054Z pretty quick. It might not be worth much on the second-hand market in a few months, maybe. I don't know. I haven't actually reviewed it.
I gave that away when I moved. So
I've still got a DS1052E at home.
Yeah.
It's still there. But yeah, no, you wouldn't use it these days. But technically, I think you can still buy it. I think you can still buy it. Yeah. And it costs more than the four-channel 1054Z. But I don't know. They've just got so much stock of these things, you know, in their bloody warehouse somewhere, in an infinite warehouse, that I don't know. They just, you can buy it, apparently. Yep. It's just nuts. Oh my god. Anyway, technology marches on.
And so do we. Our amp hour's up, Dave.
It's up.
Yes.
We're gone.
I'm gonna march on out of here.
Fine. All right. Catch you next time.
See ya.